When I was in about sixth grade, there was a major event on television, one that every family I knew watched. It was an epic story starring Cicely Tyson about a woman born in slavery who lived to be 110, long enough to see the beginnings of the civil rights movement. When the film aired in 1974, that was 3 years before Roots, it was a novelty to see African American life and history depicted with any depth or truth. That film was the autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman, and it was based on a book written by Ernest J. Gaines. Gaines went on to write other classic works of American fiction, including A Gathering of Old Men and A Lesson Before Dying. His own remarkable story is the subject of this episode of What It Takes, a podcast about passion, vision, and perseverance from the Academy of Achievement. I'm Alice Winkler.
Adam A., this child is gifted. And I heard that enough that I started to believe it.
If you have the opportunity, not a perfect opportunity, and you don't take it, you may never have another chance.
It all was so clear. It was just like the picture started to form itself.
There was no way in which a lie could prevail over the truth. Darkness over light, death over life.
Every day I wake up and decide, today I'm going to love my life. Decide.
My advice is, if they're going to break your leg once when you go in that place, stay out of there.
And then along come these differential experiences that you don't look for, you don't plan for, but boy, you better not miss them.
Ernest J. Gaines is one of America's greatest writers. His works have been translated around the world, adapted for television, and celebrated with awards galore, a National Book Critics Circle Award, a MacArthur Genius Grant, a National Humanities Medal, a National Medal of Arts. But here's what he had to say about that recognition in this 2001 interview with the Academy of Achievement.
I received that, but what about my brother, who did not receive that? What about all the others, hundreds of, well, I could probably name 50 guys my age, who would be my age now, had they lived, who were destroyed by in their 20s and their 30s and their 40s because of the world they lived in. Violent death by, you know, gunshots or knife or heart attacks or whatever, strokes, because of the kind of stress they had to live under. They did not have my chance. I'm only a chronicler. Who am I? I can only write about some things, certain things. Yeah, I went from the picking of the potatoes and picking the cotton to winning all these awards and getting paid for my stories and my books I made into films and all that sort of thing, you know. But I think about the others as well, the ones who never had a chance. And what I received as cannot possibly make up for what they've lost. Cannot possibly make up for it.
Still, Ernest Gaines has dedicated his talents and his life to telling their stories, and the stories of an America that, when he was growing up, were left out of the history books, out of the movies, and out of literature. Gaines was born in 1933 in the heart of Louisiana, in the same plantation where his people had been sharecroppers and slaves before that. His family's house was the original slave cabin, actually, that had been added onto over the years.
We did not have a school. We had a church, and we attended the church, the same church where my folks worshipped on Sundays and where my ancestors had worshipped. And classes were about 5.5 months a year. Because people had to go into the fields, children who were old enough to go to school were already, heading for the fields at 7, 8 years old, already going to the fields. And so we went to school between the crop seasons, between the planting of the crops and the harvesting of the crops, whatever it was, cotton or Irish potatoes or onions or whatever small children could do at that time. And we'd work 8 hours a day, 10 hours a day, whatever. And I remember being paid 50 cents for that day's work, picking cotton. But I was not the only one doing that. the average child at that age at the time was doing the same thing.
During World War II, Ernest Gaines' mother and stepfather, like so many African Americans of their generation, left the South to find work in the booming wartime economy of the North. They found jobs in California and left him and his six siblings behind under the care of his aunt. What little schooling they got was even harder to come by once they finished elementary school. The only school black kids could attend was 10 miles away, and they weren't allowed to ride on the school bus. So for 3 years, Ernest Gaines got to school whenever he could. But by ninth grade, there were no options, no high school that black students could attend. So his parents sent for him to join them in Vallejo, California, 30 miles northeast of San Francisco. And that is when his life began to turn around. Here's Ernest Gaines talking about that period of his life in a moving talk he gave to young delegates at the 2001 Academy of Achievement Summit.
For a long time, when I was asked how I started writing, I would say that I started writing in that Andrew Carnegie Library in Vallejo, California, 1949. But for the last few years, I've come to realize that my apprenticeship as a writer happened many years before then. Until I was 15 years old, I lived on a sugarcane plantation in South Louisiana. Many of the old people on that plantation had never gone to school a day in their life. My aunt, who raised me, told me that I should write letters for the old people who could not write and read their letters for them when they received mail. Writing the letters was a task that I did not look forward to doing because the old people had little to say after, "Dear so-and-so, how are you? I'm well, hope you are the same." After that, they became quiet, and it was my duty to create the letter by asking them questions and then adding some observations of my own. They always wanted you to write on both sides of the paper, but they had not said enough to fill the half of one side. So if you wanted to go out and shoot marbles or play baseball with your friends, you had to think and think fast, which I did. I wrote about the weather, and I wrote about the vegetable garden in the backyard and any other little thing that seemed important, all quickly as I could so I could be free to play with my other brother and my friends who were not required to do this kind of work. The old people would pay me a nickel or maybe tea cakes and milk. I did not realize that at that time I was sitting on the floor near their chairs, that I was training to be a writer. I was between 12 and 14 years old at the time, and I was as educated as anyone else on that plantation except for the school teacher who came there to teach us 5 and 6 months out of the year. As I said earlier, I went to California at the age of 15. That was at 48. My mother got a job in one of the military plants. My stepfather enlisted into the Merchant Marines, and I was sent to school. But like any 15 or 16-year-old, I wanted to be with my friends after school. If we did not play football, we would hang around on the street corners until my stepfather came in from one of his trips in the Merchant Marines and told me I'd better find something to do in my free time. I had three choices: the movies, the YMCA, or the library. I didn't have any money, so movies were out. That left the library and the YMCA. YMCA sounded more exciting. There was a basketball court, a swimming pool, a weightlifting room, and a dance floor, dance hall with a piano. I did not know how to play basketball. I could not swim. I did not know how to shoot pool or play a piano, but I hung around and watched others do these things. One day, someone asked me if I would like to put on some boxing gloves. I put on boxing gloves once or twice before, but I knew nothing about the art of boxing. But I had nothing else to do that day, and I wanted to be accepted. So I put on the gloves and got into the ring. I was to find out later that my opponent was a sparring partner for a professional fighter. But no one had to tell me that. I found that out myself by the second round. Between the first round and halfway through the second, my opponent hit me everywhere that it was legal to hit someone. Midway through the second round, I turned my back on him, and leaning back against the ropes, I began removing the gloves, using my teeth to hurry the process, while everyone in the gym stood around laughing. Next day, or a couple days later, I went to the library. This was the first time I had gone into a library, because the one in town nearby where I lived in Louisiana was for whites only. I can still remember the day I first went into that Carnegie Library in Vallejo, California. I had to go up a set of marble steps, through double doors, through a foyer, into the main room of the library. I saw two or three women behind a counter and other people reading magazines and newspapers at tables. These people were of different races and different ages, so I felt it was all right for me to be there too. I approached the magazine rack, took a magazine at random, and sat down at the table. No one paid me any attention, but I watched everything around me. I looked over the top of the magazine much more than I did reading it. For the next few days, I must have done the same thing. Took a magazine or a newspaper off the rack, sat down at the table, and looked around. About a week after I had been going to the library, I noticed a narrow set of stairs leading up to a second floor. It took me a while to build up the courage to go up there, and it was like taking a trip into a foreign country. There were racks and racks and racks of books, more books than I could have imagined existed. I walked down every aisle that was not occupied by someone else, looking at the books, the titles, the author's names, but never removing the books from the shelves. I know I did not check a book out that day and maybe several days before I took a book home. But whether I was taking a book home or reading it at the library, I became aware that I was choosing books with certain titles without really knowing why. If the title had road in it, or water, or tree, or land, or field, or country, or farm, I would take that book from the shelf. Later, I realized that I chose those titles because I was looking for something about my background, southern and rural. During my first 15 and a half years, I had lived on a plantation where I'd worked in the fields from the time I was 8 years old. I'd fished in the bayous and the rivers at about that same age, and I'd gone into the swamps to pull the end of a handsaw when I was no more than 11. So when tree came up in a title, or earth in the title, or land, or water in the title, my interest perked up as well. But many of these books left me with a feeling of disappointment. Though they spoke of earth, land, water, trees, and the people who lived and worked there, they were not describing my people, the people I had left in the South, my aunt who raised me, and the old people who visited her, for whom I wrote the letters. They were not describing my brothers and my uncles. They were not talking about my friends with whom I played ball and shot marbles. They were talking about others, and I did not see me there.
In 1949, Gaines went on to say, his mother had a baby boy named Michael, and it fell to Gaines to watch his brother while his mother was at work. He figured it was his big chance to write a novel. It couldn't be too hard, he thought, judging from the number of books there were in the library. He was 16. When he finished a draft, longhand, his mother rented him a typewriter.
I knew nothing at all about typing, just as I would find out later that I knew nothing at all about writing a novel. I would spend hours on hours pecking on the typewriter with one finger while I kept my other hand over Michael's eyes until he went to sleep. Since books are printed on sheets about half the size of the average sheet of paper, I decided to cut my sheets of paper in half. Since books are printed on both sides of the pages, I did that as well. Since books are printed in simple single space, I did that too. I want to make it easy for the publishers. I finished my novel sometime during the summer or winter of 1950. I found some brown wrapping paper in the kitchen and some strings and somewhere in a drawer, and I wrapped it up and tied the manuscript and sent it to New York. A month or so later, it came back accompanied by one of those patented rejection slips, sorry, but keep us in mind. I took the manuscript outside and burned it in the incinerator.
And that was it, but only for a little while. He had discovered the library and fallen in love with literature, and there was no turning back.
I read plays, I read poetry, I read novels. I especially liked the 19th century Russian novelist, Turgenev, the stories of Tolstoy and Chekhov stories. And I began to read them because, I suppose because the relationship between those landowners and their peasants, their serfs, was so much like and not like the ones that I had come from. I read Ivan Turgenev's His Fathers and Sons, and that book had a tremendous impact on me. It was about a young man who came back to the old village to visit the old people after he had graduated from his university, and he used to be a doctor. Falls in love with a beautiful woman and all that sort of thing. They lived out in the country, and I knew nothing about writing a novel. And I used that Fathers and Sons as sort of my Bible, my guide. And my first novel was about a young man who had been away from the old place, and then returning and falls in love with a beautiful girl, and he loses her. And I was really very much influenced by Turgenev's Fathers and Sons at that time. It was small, it was tightly written, it was about the country and older people and a young educated man who was a nihilist. And so I thought at that time I was a nihilist too.
When he graduated from high school, Gaines went to a junior college in Vallejo. He couldn't afford to go anywhere else. Then he did a stint in the Army, and finally he was able to study literature at San Francisco State, where his professors encouraged him to write and to write about what he knew. He got two stories published in the Student Library magazine, and those helped him get a fellowship to study at Stanford under the amazing writer Wallace Stegner.
He's a wonderful critic, not only a writer himself, but just a wonderful teacher. And he asked me, who was I writing for? And I said, well, Wally. He wanted us to call him Wally, you know, because we're all informal around the place. He didn't want anyone to call him Mr. Stegner or anything like that. I said, well, Wally, I don't write for anybody in particular. I said, I've learned from many writers, from a writer like Ivan Turgenev, and I said, here was this aristocrat writing in the mid-19th century, and I knew he was not writing for an Ernie Gaines on Louisiana plantation. And I said, still, I learned from him because the way he wrote that little novel. I learned about a young man coming back to the old place and how he reacted to the old place. I said, I didn't know anything about that until I read that book. And he said, listener, and he said, suppose a gun was put at your head and that same question was asked, who do you write for? I said, well, in that case, I'll come up with an answer. And I said the answer would be that first, I'd write for the young black youth of the South so that I can help him in some ways to find himself, his directions in life, let him know something about where he's coming from, where he came from, and how to try to help him find his way. And he said, then Wally said, well, suppose that gun was still at your head. And I said, well, then I'd write for the white youth of the South to let him know that unless he knows his neighbor of the last 350 years, he knows only half of his own history. So that was all the discussion on who I write for. But I don't write for any particular group. When I face that wall, when I sit at that desk and face that wall to write, looking at the blank wall, I just try to create those characters as well as I possibly can create them.
To do that well, Ernest Gaines says he listens for their voices. And usually the voices he hears most clearly come from Louisiana, a place he left in 1948. As he described it to interviewer Gail Eichenthal in this conversation, his body may have gone to California to be educated, but his soul stayed forever in Louisiana.
Friends have suggested, and editors and publishers and agents too, that should maybe write some about something else, but I can't. Yes, it was pretty hard, tough, living in the South as a small, black child during that time. But I had a lot of fun too. There were some happy days. We could fish. We could hunt. We played a lot. We could walk from distances without anybody caring about you walking across properties. We could collect the different fruit that grew in the fields and the trees along the road. Those are some wonderful moments. And the people whom I loved most, including my aunt and many of the older people, were still there.
When Ernest Gaines began working on the autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman, this was in 1968, it wasn't a first-person narrative at all. His original idea was to use the voices of people gathered at the funeral of an old lady to tell the story of life on the plantation.
And so I thought I would write a novel like that, because I had heard the old people who used to visit my aunt, because my aunt could not travel. They used to come there, and they used to talk all the time. They talked during the out on the porch during the day. Around, if it was cold, around the fireplace at night, they were always talking. And I knew they talked about all kinds of things. They talked about what they had heard about slavery, vicariously, of course, about religion, or politics. They were always talking.
Ernest Gaines tried channeling all those voices from his childhood into the novel. He worked on it for well over a year.
But they talked so much about her that I fell in love with her. And then it was then that I decided to write the book from her point of view. So I started in chapter one.
It was a day something like right now, dry, hot, and dusty. It might have been July. I'm not too sure, but it was July or August, burning up. I won't ever forget. The Secesh Army, they came by first. The officers on their horses, the troops walking, some of them dragging the guns in the dust, they were so tired. The officers rode up in the yard, and my mistress told them to get down and come in. The colonel said he couldn't come in. He was gone somewhere in a hurry, but he would be glad to get down and stretch his legs if the good lady of the house would be so gracious to let him. My mistress said she most graciously did, and after the colonel had got down, he told the others to get down too. The colonel was a little man with a gun and a sable. The sable was so long it almost dragged on the ground. Looked like the colonel was a little boy who had got somebody else's sable to play with. My mistress told me stop standing there gaping, go out there in the road and give the troops some water. I had the water in a barrel under one of the china ball trees. We knowed the soldiers was coming that way. We had heard the gunfire the day before, and somebody had already passed the house and told us if the soldiers came by, be prepared to help in every way we could. So they had put me to hauling water. All morning long I hauled water to that barrel. Now I had to haul the water out the barrel to the troops out in the road. Buckets after buckets after buckets. I can't remember how many buckets I hauled. The troops were so tired and ragged, they didn't even see me. They took the gourd from me when I handed it to them, and that was all. After they had drunk, they just let it hang there in their hands, and I had to reach and get it so I could serve another one. But they didn't even see little old black me.
I know some people have said that Miss Jane Pittman is my aunt. No, she's not, but Miss Jane has my aunt's spirit and courage and feisty. Well, my aunt wasn't too feisty. She was just strong, courageous. Most courageous person I've ever met, I suppose, ever lived on Earth as far as I'm concerned. Probably greatest influence in my life. She was crippled. She never walked in her life. She crawled over the floor all her life. When my mother had to go out into the fields when we were smaller children and then later go to California, she left us with my aunt. And, you know, my aunt could do everything except walk. You know, she cooked the food for us. So we had to bring everything to the stove. We had an old wood burning stove. She cooked the food for us. She washed our clothes on this old washboard. And we had to bring all the stuff there, the water, the soap, the washboard itself. And she also disciplined us. But so we had to break our own switch to get our punishment if we did something wrong. So we'd go out and break our own switch and come back and let her take our punishment. She had to crawl over the floor. But she liked going out into the garden. We had a little vegetable garden beside the house. From the time of slavery, they always gave us, you know, the slaves a little place to plant vegetables. So even when I grew up, there was still a little vegetable garden beside the house. And when it was cool enough in the afternoon, she would crawl over the floor down the steps, and she had a little short-handled hoe which she would work around the beans or okra or tomatoes or whatever we had growing in the garden during that time. We had a pecan tree in our backyard, and during the fall, September, October, she would crawl over the yard and gather pecans in a little sack and bring them back to the house and crack the pecans and make a candy or cookies, whatever. And all the time that I knew my aunt, and she raised me until I was 15 and a half years old, I never heard her complain once about anything. Never heard her complain once. So I think it was she who had the greatest influence on me. both as an artist as well as a man. Many times in my early age, I wanted to, when things were not working right for me in my writing, I wanted to give up, but I could not afford to give up because I remember her and the things that she had to go through in her lifetime.
Ernest Gaines' great-aunt was named Augustine Jefferson, and remarkably, she raised his six younger siblings as well. Later on, when Gaines was living in California, he missed his aunt and his siblings to no end. Reading stories and novels became one of the ways he tried to combat his loneliness. When he thought about becoming a writer himself, his aunt was the main person he wanted to impress. But by the time he got his first book published, she had died. In many ways, all of his books are a tribute to his aunt. There are, of course, the voices he heard in her home that echo in his head. And there's the setting, Louisiana. But there's something else, too.
A common theme in my writing, one of the themes in my writing, has been about someone teaching someone younger something about life. Miss Jane does the same thing. And Of Love and Dust, we get the same thing. A short story called Three Men, we get the same thing. Someone's teaching somebody. Catherine Carmier. It was not always a teacher, but an older person, a much more wise person, teaching a younger person about life.
And that's certainly one of the storylines that runs through Ernest Gaines' most famous book of the last 30 years, A Lesson Before Dying. The story of two characters, a teacher and an innocent man on death row in Louisiana in the 1940s.
I try to bring those two things together. What does this young man owe to the world, when he's going to be executed for a crime he did not commit? What does he owe to the world? What does he owe to himself but to think that he's a piece of nothing? It's all he's been taught since a small child growing up on a plantation, such as the one I created for that. He's never been given love or except by his godmother.
Here's a courtroom scene from the movie version of A Lesson Before Dying. It's very true to the language in the book.
Gentlemen of the jury, I ask you to look at my client. Ask yourselves, is that a man you see sitting there? Do you see anyone who could plan a murder? Would you call this a man? A fool, perhaps, a fool who is not aware of right and wrong. A fool who stood by and watched this happen, not having the sense to run. No, gentlemen, not a man. What you see there is the thing that acts on command, a thing to hold the handle of a plow, to chop your wood and pull your corn, but not a thing capable of planning a robbery or a murder. Gentlemen of the jury, who would be hurt if you took this life? If you convicted this boy, who would be hurt? Look back at that last row. That woman you see there has been everything to him. Mama, grandmother, godmother. Look at her, gentlemen. Now, we may not see him as much, but he is her reason for existence. Think on that, gentlemen. And for God's sake, be merciful. He is innocent of all charges brought against him. But let us for a moment say he was not. Even so, what justice would there be to take his life? Justice, gentlemen, well, you might just as soon put a hog in the electric chair as this. Just a poor, dumb hog.
Jefferson, the young black man on trial, is found guilty and is sentenced to die. Meanwhile, the teacher on the plantation where Jefferson went to school hates his job. He's a smart guy who could have been a businessman or an attorney or a politician, except for the fact that he is black and it's the 1940s.
He would like to do other things, run away, get away from there. But he's kept there by his aunt. His aunt makes such demands that he must stay around to help, try to help the children in the school. And he does it very poorly until he has to go to this young man, Jefferson, on death row. And it was there that he tries to reach him, try to teach him that you know, you've gotten a rotten deal in this world, but at the same time, you got to be somebody. You got to realize that you are somebody. And he's telling him this at the same time he still would like to run away. So, but as Jefferson began to come around, and takes a long time, it doesn't happen. It does not happen overnight. When he begins to come around and begin to think that maybe he is somebody, this began to gradually work on the teacher himself. And it makes the teacher more humane toward others around him, toward his students, toward the older people around him, and toward his lady friend. And a common theme I have, I run through so much of my work, is that theme of commitment, a responsibility, that we are responsible for ourselves, regardless of whether we have 4 or 5 months to live, as Jefferson has, before he had to be executed, or someone like Grant, who would have maybe 50 years more to live. What do you do with that time? What are you going to do for yourself, your family, your community? What do you do with your life during that time?
The idea for the story in A Lesson Before Dying came to Ernest Gaines when he was living in San Francisco, across the bay from the notorious San Quentin prison, where all death row prisoners in the state of California were executed.
And whenever there was an execution, I would not write that day. I couldn't work that day. I couldn't do anything on the day before. Trying to imagine what this person was going through. I would take off my watch and leave my watch. I'd go to the ocean and stay at the ocean. The day of the execution, it was always 10 o'clock in the morning, and I would always just get away from everything, get away from people, and go to the ocean. I could walk to the ocean, which is about 4.5 miles from where my house, and I just stay there. I was always haunted by people being executed for years and years. How do you feel about it? And I realized that in order to try to get rid of this, exercise this, I had to try to write about it. One of my favorite books about young people being executed was Andreas, the Seven Who Were Hanged. Just a fantastic story. Andreev was a Russian writer in the latter part of the 19th century. I forget his name right now, first name. And I learned a lot about, since there were seven of them, I learned a lot about how their habits, knowing that they were going to die in a certain morning. And I thought that maybe I could write a story somewhat like that.
A Lesson Before Dying was published in 1993 and became a bestseller. It won the National Book Critics Circle Award. It was an Oprah Book Club selection, and it was made into an HBO movie you heard a clip from, which won 2 Emmys. In 2001, when Gail Eichenthal sat down for this interview with Ernest Gaines, he hadn't published anything since. She asked him what he was working on next.
It's been a long time since I've written anything that's publishable. My latest novel was 7 years ago now, almost 8 years ago. And I have something in mind. It's Louisiana again. I suppose by now I could have written something about California. I've tried to write about California. Try to write a ghost story. I tell people that I was so vivid that I scared myself, but that's not really, really true. It was just bad stuff. I tried to write Bohemian Life about my Bohemian life in San Francisco, but I was not very good at that because I couldn't take the sandwiches and the wine all the time. I've tried to write about my Army experience. I was stationed on Guam for a year, but I found that I was writing too much. I was repeating Mr. Roberts or something like that, you know. So I had to come back to Louisiana, and it's been sort of difficult to get a novel about Louisiana, but I think I have something in mind now that might eventually turn into a novel. It's about time. I should hope within the next couple of years at least, that would be exactly 10 years since A Lesson came out, A Lesson Before Dying came out. But A Lesson Before Dying came out 10 years after A Gathering of Old Men, so maybe I'm one of these every 10-year publishing writer. There was a time when I wrote 4 books in 10 years, but now it's harder to do. When I was poor and nobody knew who I was, I had nothing but time to write. Now, you know, my books are out there and they're being taught in high school, universities, colleges all over the country. And I'm always being invited to come to these places and talk to students because they're studying my books. And I go. So when no one knew my name, I wrote. When now they don't know my name, I'm visiting. Maybe that's success. Maybe that's what success does to some people.
But Ernest Gaines was pretty close in his prediction. About 12 years after A Lesson Before Dying, he came out with a book of stories and essays called Mozart and Lead Belly. And 12 years after that, just this past summer, 2017, he released a novella, The Tragedy of Brady Sims, about the extreme measures one man takes to try and shield the black children in his small town from the unjust world they live in.
Now that I look back on my career for the past 40-some years, I feel that I'm still writing those letters for those old people, not only for the old, but for the young as well, and not only for those whom I knew as a child, but for those who lived many generations before. They were not given a chance to read and write, and I was. But without their voices, had I not sat on that porch and wrote those letters 55 years ago, I'm certain that I would not be standing here tonight. After all, what else would I have had to write about? Thank you very much.
These days, Ernest Gaines and his wife divide their time between San Francisco and that same piece of Louisiana land, once a plantation, where he grew up. He even bought the church where his family prayed for generations and had it moved to his property. You know, in Louisiana, there's a term used to describe a little something extra, a bonus treat. The term is lagniappe, and I've got a lagniappe for you to close out this episode. Ernest Gaines' description of the American dream as he sees it.
Without love for my fellow man and respect for nature, to me, life is an obscenity. So that can be my feeling of the American dream. Unless we care for one another and care for the world we live in, then it's, what is the purpose of our life here?
I'm Alice Winkler, and this is What It Takes from the Academy of Achievement. Thanks so much for listening. What It Takes is generously funded by the Catherine B. Reynolds Foundation.